Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Hey, I heard you need an inspiration. He's Ilana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Little known fact about my guest today, he had that rare thing happened where a playwright asked him to just read the first draft of a play. Then when it was being done off Broadway, he was asked to be in it. Then it went to London, then it went to LA, and then it went to Broadway. And then he was nominated for a Tony, the play Clybourne Park, the actor Jeremy Shamos, and he is today's guest on my podcast. Welcome, Jeremy.
A-OK.
Hey everyone, my guest today is Jeremy Shamos. Jeremy was nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Clybourne Park. His other stage appearances include the Broadway productions of Meteor Shower, Noises Off, The Assembled Parties, and Glengarry Glen Ross. Some of his off-Broadway productions include, most recently, Here We Are, the original Gutenberg the Musical, If I Forget, The Qualms, The Complete Life Works of Shakespeare, Dinner with Friends, and many, many more. His work on film and television has provided the opportunity for Jeremy to collaborate on many acclaimed features, including Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Bad Education, The Big Sick, Birdman, and his many TV series include The Handmaid's Tale, Better Call Saul, Succession, Dead Ringers, Nurse Jackie, Fosse Verdon, The Gilded Age, and Only Murders in the Building. Hello, Jeremy Shamos.
Hello. Wow.
That's nothing. That's nothing. That's not even all.
That was the tip of the iceberg.
Wait, I lost you. Your sound for a minute. Are you there?
You're kidding.
You're back now. You're back.
Oh, gosh.
He's also a mime.
Yeah, I'm going to do this whole thing without actually speaking.
Mime. Do you have mime skills? Any special skills you can share?
I don't know that I have mime skills, but in grad school, we had to do a neutral mask class where everyone in the entire class wore a black unitard. And then, I mean, that's all you need to know.
But a neutral mask, that's like a neutral body garment. Yeah,
then we wore, there was like a mask that had like a neutral expression. And then you sort of try to tell a story with your whole body, and the mask sort of changes because the person's doing something happy. You kind of are like, oh, the mask sort of seems happy now. And that's the theory.
It works.
And sometimes it works. So that's a long introduction for the fact that I'm going to wear my neutral mask
Go get it. So let's talk about that for a minute, and then we'll get into all the things. But were you?
We'll talk about neutral mask for like 15 minutes, and then we'll get on.
We'll do 15 on the NM. When you think back to yourself as someone who studied, like went to college and grad school for theater, were you excited about that kind of stuff? Were you like, "Yay, it's unitard neutral mask day," or were you an eye roller?
Yeah, I tried not to be an eye roller, although before we went to grad school, we got sort of a list of things that we needed to have. And one of them was like a dance belt and a unitard. And I rolled my eyes just privately. And then when I met everyone, we all were, weirded out by it. But no, I tried to get stuff out of it. I mean, I think like, as we talk about my experience in acting, I think my feeling about school is complicated, and ultimately I'm so glad that I went. But a lot of things, a lot of my approach a little bit was also like, I felt like there were things that people knew. And then I got there and I was like, oh, actually, no one really totally knows what's going on. So which made me feel a little bit more comfortable with the fact that I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I still struggle with that, but at least I know that the people with MFAs don't know more than me because I was there.
Right. And that's good. That's a good,
it's a good listener, crutch.
Listeners at home, that is good to know. You can still go, you can go, but don't expect, it's not like a golden key that opens the lock to the thing, the mystery of it all.
No, I mean, it opened a lock. Again, we can talk about this, but it opened a lock to the business in a way that was, you know, that's frustrating for people that didn't go. And I get it because I was a person who hadn't gone.
Right.
But in terms of techniques and things, I think, you know, I think you gather things over the course of time, but it's not like, yeah, there's moments of like, oh my God, I've been doing this wrong.
Well, or you have.
Yeah, no, or you have, and somehow you keep getting away with it, which is really the
and that's
result.
What we're here to talk about today.
And that's what we're here to talk about. Yeah.
That is like how to get away with it. You, I mean, because actually, all kidding aside, that is, if I look at like, I mean, you're going to be maybe like episode 400, right? Of like people I admire so much, and there is sort
and
of
I did take note of that.
400. That's a bit. That's you
really
like a special
admire the number 400. Yeah, I admire 399 people more than you, but you're top 500.
No, this is like a huge thing. This is the hugest.
This is a huge
get.
You've wanted me to do this since. Like,
I felt like I had to prove
episode.
Myself. I felt like let me prove myself before I get to Jeremy because he'll say no 399 times. But with the list
exactly.
Now,
you timed it perfectly. It's
perhaps
impressive.
He will say yes.
Sorry, I've been interrupting you nonstop.
Are you kidding? This is fantastic. The other name for this episode, it'll be Little Known Facts with Jeremy Shamos, and then underneath will be The Interrupter. And
yeah,
it's going to be perfect. No,
with
are
Alana
you
Levine.
Kidding? With Alana Levine. I'm so happy right now. You went to NYU. That's the school we're talking about. And so before we jump into sort of all the things that happened after NYU, all I know about is that you grew up in Denver. That's sort of what I know. And so how from growing up in Denver and I assume doing theater in Denver and loving it, like how did you decide for college I'm going to go here? What was sort of the thinking?
Yeah, so my parents both grew up in New York, in Manhattan. They were Upper East Side kids. They both went to Dalton and were like Upper East Side kids, and lived here, got married here, had my sister here, had me here, and then in the early 70s, when I was very young, they followed a political candidate out to try to get him elected in Colorado and ended up moving there away from everyone, the family. And so they were sort of the only people that were out west. So we came back here a lot, and my parents were still kind of New Yorkers, even though we were on a suburban block in Denver.
Right.
So we came back here a lot and saw theater, and my parents were always into theater, and we had like cast albums, and I always saw like plays in New York, and we went to see family like a couple times a year, definitely once a year. So I loved the theater, and kind of always, I don't know, I always felt like I was going to move back to New York. I always sort of like, I had a Yankees hat, and I don't know, it just sort of seemed like I really loved visiting here. A weird thing is like, I always noticed the humidity when I came here, because it's so dry in Denver. Now I don't notice the humidity, but I remember every time I got here, it was like, oh my God, it's like a sauna. Interesting fact. That's the little known fact. Anyway.
Yeah. It's
Denver's
funny. Obviously, these are summer New York experiences.
Well, I came in the summer. I sometimes came in the, yeah, I know. But I think we don't even notice the humidity in the fall. And it's
I love
like
that.
Humid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Yeah, so when I was in fourth grade, I joined a choir in Denver that's called the Colorado Children's Chorale, and it's very professional choir. And I also played soccer competitively, and I was always sort of like those two things were always sort of battling for me. But the interesting thing about the choir is that it was incredibly professional. The head of the choir was like, it was like non-negotiable that you would miss a practice or miss a performance. That was just like the bar. Whereas I could call my soccer coach and miss a game and he was disappointed and pissed off, but it wasn't like, so I kind of always had a professional feeling about performing in a weird way. I was thinking about this because I knew I was coming on to the show, but, and then in sixth grade, the beginning of sixth grade, they were doing a show at the Denver Center, which is the big Equity Theater in Denver. And at the time they had a company. It was like the times when regional theaters had companies, like Mercedes Rule was in the company. It was like a company of actors. And so they called the choir because they needed a kid and they recommended me and I went to audition and I got a part in this, in a production of Androcles and the Lion by George Bernard Shaw. And I was going to sing Silent Night at the end, but I was in the play, like, I don't even know if I had lines, but I had like a little wig and I like carried an umbrella for people. But I mean, I was backstage and it was like, you know, they seemed very old to me, but now I'm thinking they were probably in their 20s, you know, maybe in their 30s, the older people, maybe in their 40s. Right. It was a company. And it was just like they treated me so like an adult, which I always kind of felt like anyway. I was kind of precocious and liked spending time with adults too and kids. But they kind of just, they were funny. You know, there was like, they were smoking backstage. It was like a different world, but it was like everyone was like cussing. And it's like the backstage of a theater, but I was 11.
Yes. Yes, but the green room life, just, like being a part my God. Of that is the best. It's yeah. the best. Yeah.
It's the best. And then like going to the wig room and talking to the wig person and yeah, it was the best. And then I was doing a show and people were coming to see it. And, you know, I mean, before that I had done a Christmas pageant at my school and gotten cast in a kind of a good part. And I got to wear my pajamas and that's like playing a kid on Christmas morning. I know. And I was with like a high school girl that was playing my mom and I was so in love with her. I hope she's watching or listening.
So she was like the Elizabeth Taylor to your, is his name Larry? I can't remember Elizabeth Taylor's much younger husband's name, but that's what I pictured.
Yes, that's what it was. That's what Thank it was. You. I think it actually was Elizabeth. It was Liz Taylor. She was a senior.
And you were
and I was great. Totally in love with this woman and I was so then I was also just like this is fun, this is awesome acting. Yeah, so I did that play and then I was sort of like from then on I was like I kind of already knew that I liked to perform, but so I always pictured myself coming, that's a long way of saying I always pictured myself coming back to New York, and I wanted to be an actor and I wanted to be an actor in the theater. That's what I had done. And and then weirdly, when I was, I'm really talking a lot, but I guess I'm the guest of the show.
It's a podcast. Yeah, you know. This is good.
Yeah, I forgot. I got cast in the movie when I was in ninth grade. That the production company was in Denver, but it was shooting in the Pacific Northwest. And it was about this kid who gets sort of kidnapped. And it was almost like a Disney movie, but it wasn't Disney, but it was like, he gets like trapped and he has to like survive in nature and he's like a city kid. And someone's parent had recommended me. They knew a PA or something. I don't know. Anyway, I auditioned and I went in ninth grade. I went for 5 weeks to Port Angeles, Washington, and I filmed this movie and like stayed in a hotel. And
did one of your parents go with you?
Well, no, my parents were actually cool because I don't know, somehow I didn't want them to.
How old were you?
I wanted it to be my experience.
Right.
I was in ninth grade. I was 14.
Was this a union movie?
Yeah, I became SAG member. I made money. And I'm terrible in it. You know, I mean, I it's really weird. No, but you know, because some kids are really good actors.
You were not a natural film actor at the time.
I don't think I am. But yes, it was, I just didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, but it was a cool experience. And also it just reinforced the idea that, like, gosh, I guess I could be like an actor and make money and make a living of it. And, you know, people are responding to what I can do, even though I don't know what I'm doing, you know, which is a running theme.
Certainly in this conversation.
No, in life.
Okay.
Yes, in this conversation.
You had two paid professional gigs by the time you were like 14 years old. So that's
in ninth grade. And
unusual.
Yeah. And then I did a production of Brighton Beach Memoirs at a community theater. And it was just very successful. I got like good reviews. I got like some theater award. And so I just got a lot of encouragement, like from, you know, outward coming from the outside, which was very encouraging. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know. Yeah, I think that was great. And my parents were always supportive, which was a huge, huge thing.
You started working, well, as a kid, but here in New York, like, you built this incredibly beautiful life in the theater, like one brick at a time. When you look back, having ended up at NYU, you know, for so many people, that becomes like their first community of other people wanting to do the same thing. And out of that world of unitards and masks, you made great friends, many of whom have gone on like you to do like really beautiful, beautiful work. Talk a little bit about sort of the beginning and sort of beginning to work in earnest in New York. And when you look back, what was the, like, you know, it was really lucky, Alana, I got to be in this, and it opened up the following. Can you sort of think about that and what that is for you?
Yeah, I have to go back to the fact that, so I went to undergrad at NYU as well, and I graduated, and like I said, I didn't get an agent. And a lot of people, I was in a group of people that wanted to start a theater company, because that's like what everybody was doing. And everybody wanted to like be Steppenwolf and have their own like group. And so we kind of tried to do that, but it was just a lot of like, we didn't really get that off the ground. But then I got these Kmart commercials, and it was like a series of commercials. It wasn't just one commercial. It was seasonal, because there were these sort of realistic Kmart commercials, realistic, but that film director John Hancock directed. And it was like, there was like a couple walking through, and then there was like a sort of like an older couple, and there was like a family. And so I was part of like the kind of young couple. And so it would be seasonal. We did it like four times a year. So I was in these national commercials four times a year. So I actually got paid. Which is how I originally put like money into getting an apartment, and which was a huge thing to have in New York, as you know, like real estate becomes like a major player in being able to stay here and not work. But I was not working in the professional theater as much as doing like downtown. I did a ton of shows downtown at like NADA. Do you remember NADA?
No.
On Ludlow, down by Katz's Deli, there was like a theater called NADA. Okay. And it was like, you couldn't raise your arms all the way up, you know, the lights were, you know, so all your gestures were
tiny.
Like a smaller, yeah, were tiny. But it was favored me, because I'm only 5'10", so no tall actors. It was good.
Right.
So I just did like a bunch
of work from backstage. Like, how are you, or like a friend?
No, I got work from friends from, I got for work from friends from college who were doing, we weren't like necessarily a company, but people were like, I'm putting up a Václav Havel show. And you know, or someone like wrote a new play, like an experimental play, and we're doing it such and such. And then it was like, then I started sort of like other people who I didn't know who I met there wanted me to be in their play and doing readings. And it was really a creative time. And also doing that kind of theater makes you like sort of incredibly flexible, because I wasn't doing like Arthur Miller plays. I was doing like, now you're a dog and then like you're a tree and then, you know,
totally
you
experimental.
Say these, yeah. And then you have like a page that you have to memorize that like Mack Wellman that doesn't totally make sense, but you try to find your way through it. And so that was a kind of its own training in another way. And also meeting a lot of people in New York. But when I did go to see professional plays, which I still always tried to do, sometimes I would like second act it and just like get someone's program and go to second act.
Yeah.
But usually in the playbill, I felt like the people that were my age had gone to NYU or Yale or Juilliard, and it was like almost constant. And I felt so, you know, just like left out of that world. I had like one or two auditions for something like, but I definitely was like sort of on the outside of that world. And so I had a friend who, Sam Catlin, who was a year ahead of me at NYU, and he went to NYU. He was in the theater company that we were trying to start and had gone to undergrad, and he went to NYU, and he was like, I really think that you would like going to grad school at NYU. It's like amazing. He was sort of halfway through his first year, and it was one of the things that I had seen in playbills. So I was really at a point where I was like, I'm going to audition for that. And also I think it will help me, because you have to write an essay about what you want and, you know, who you are as an actor and what you want as an actor. And I said, I thought to myself, like, I'm going to do this. It'll help me sort of actually put into words and in my own focus, like, what is it that I really do want? And I'll prepare these pieces and I'll, you know, but I really was like at a point where I was like, if I don't get in, I think I might have to do something else, which I don't know what that would have been. I mean, I don't know what that would have been, but it was sort of at a point where I wasn't making money. And I was, you know, like when I would do a show, I'd get like subway tokens, stuff like that. So it was like, and I got in. So, and like I said before, it was very much a way of sort of also, I thought either I'm going to learn something that these people that are in these plays know that I don't know, or I'm going to be at least in the running for those things, cause I will have gotten out. And maybe at the end I'll say like, I actually do know what I'm doing, but you know, I have this sort of pedigree. So going back to getting out of school, I feel like I did learn things, and I also made a great group of friends, and I started doing, figuring out how to do more things more in a more focused way or something. I don't know. But, yeah, my big sort of lucky thing was that I got out of school and I did Shakespeare in the Park, which a lot of people do right when they get out of school. I was in Andre Serban's production of Cymbeline, I mean, like a spear carrier. And while I was in that, they were casting Corpus Christi, the Terrence McNally play. That
super
was like incredibly
controversial.
And I learned about it because it was in the paper, because Lynn Meadow had canceled it because they had gotten bomb threats. And then all these artists wrote this open letter and signed it and said they would never work at MTC if they didn't do this play, and that if they didn't like succumb to these threats. So I knew that it was a play about 13 young guys. And so the audition process was like, you kind of just make your own piece. And so I created this thing that I'm still proud of, and I wish I had it written down, where I played all these characters, and it was like a cool thing that I did. And I hate auditioning, and I always have. But somehow this was like, I think maybe because it was like very much in my court, like just to create something.
Yeah.
And I had just gotten out of school, so I even like went back to school and used one of the studios at school. And so I kind of was used to making stuff or working on stuff. Like now, I think that would intimidate me or just be strange. But at the time, I was like, oh, sure, I'll make a thing. And Joe Mantello directed it, and like I got cast. So I was immediately in, like, got an equity card, was in like an off-Broadway play. Everybody saw it because it was controversial and everybody wanted to support it. And, you know, it was this great Michael C. Hall and Josh Lucas and Chris Fitzgerald and Drew McBeady and Michael Irby. And it was a cast of like 13 guys. And it was an experience because it was sort of also, you know, outside there were protests. We had sort of all these security protocols about, you know, there were all these ex-FBI guys who had a company, I forgot what the company was called, you know, and so we would have these meetings. If someone's following you, go into a building, call this number. Like, it was very, you know, so you kind of felt like we're making this dangerous art. I mean, the show itself turns out not to be dangerous at all, and it's very solemn, and, you know, it seems like it actually could be made by a church group, you know. But it was really cool, and Joe was young, and we were all young.
And beginning his directing career, and in earnest, and then, like, recently, you were reunited with Joe in this incredible musical, Here We Are, Sondheim's Last Piece, with a book by David Ives. Joe was on the show recently, Dennis O'Hare, other people. I loved it. I thought it was a really complicated, beautiful, but I imagine a very hard piece to put together. But it really shows, like, oh, I guess I am good to work with because people like me. And, you know, you've had recurring relationships with directors and theaters, and that must feel really gratifying. So what is it like? I mean, you're so funny as a human. You're very funny and you're very quick, but it's been, I'm actually looking, this is me and Bruce Norris in a play called Wrong Mountain that we did together, sort of on the eve of him leaving Broadway as an actor and becoming a Broadway scribe. I remember him writing so many different things backstage.
That's a great picture.
It is a great picture because he's hilarious, actually, and one of a kind, and such a good actor, and such an amazingly controversial human being to spend time with in the best way.
Yes.
But I bring that up. He's so provocative. And at times on stage, it's extraordinary to be in the audience. At dinner, just the two of you, you're like, I want to eat this fettuccine Alfredo without talking about having sex with dead people. Like, I just want to eat my dinner. But on stage, it's fantastic. And it won a Pulitzer. Like, it's incredible. And we're talking about Clybourne Park, the play that, of all the plays so far, that's the one that included with it came a Tony nomination.
Yeah.
It came with the part.
No, it's part of the cast of characters. It's
yes.
Like this person, this person's husband, Tony nomination.
Yes. So that.
Yeah.
Is amazing.
That's nice when you see
that's
that.
Nice. Yes, that's we're good. Like, I'm going to read for that. I hate auditioning, but I'll audition for that part. Jeremy, that had to be thrilling. So I'm jumping around a little bit from Nada to,
fine.
but I was thrilled for you, and I want to know what that felt like on the day and what the expectations were already. It had been off Broadway, and the thrill. Oh my God, it's actually moving. That never happens. It is with such an incredible company. Annie Paris was this week's episode. I mean, just so many beautiful humans involved in that play at different times.
Yeah.
So can you just talk a little bit about that morning and that experience?
Well, going back slightly, like the whole Clybourne Park experience is like, and this is like an important little story for people who are listening who haven't had that kind of like break, or is that I auditioned for, I didn't know Bruce, and I auditioned for The Pain in the Itch, another play that he did at Playwrights Horizons. And I think the late, great Chris Evan Welch got the part. But I remember that I auditioned and I felt like Bruce as an actor, he like really took the time and Pam, I don't know who was directing, I don't know. But Bruce really took the time to tell me that I did a great job. I came for the callback and he was just incredibly nice and basically was telling me like, I really like your acting, you know? And then Club Thumb, the theater company, they were doing some kind of fundraiser and Pam McKinnon was directing some little play that Bruce wrote and they asked me to do it. And I did that. And so then all of a sudden it's like in this business, it's like, now I know Bruce and I know Pam because I did this little tiny thing at the Ohio Theater, you know, for one night, almost like a reading. And then they asked me to do a reading of Clybourne Park and they were thinking about doing it at MCC, I think. And so we were at Telsey's and maybe Playwrights, maybe they were going to do a co-production. Anyway, we did the reading and the play, you know, Bruce as a writer is not like a big rewriter. He's not like a development person. He's not, doesn't get into the whole, like, let's do a workshop. And then like a year later, I've added this. It's like the play was very much like the play and it was incredible. And I remember reading it and being like, this is incredible play, you know, which is rare. I mean, it's unique to have something like that in your hand. And then we did the reading and then, I mean, more than half the people I think that were in the reading just got offered to do the play. So I was like, the fact that we got to do that play, I was thrilled. I think I was doing a play at the time, but I kind of couldn't wait to do that play. So then, yeah, like you said, I'd been in so many off-Broadway shows that I thought were great. And I won an Obie for one of them and was hoping that it would move and more people would get to see it. And that's sort of the thing about doing an off-Broadway play. There's a lot of times, if you're in something that's great, you just think like, maybe this will move on and it'll have another life, you know? And people always ask that after the show, like, so what's next for this play? And you're always like, it closes next week and it'll be over on Sunday.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it. You just saw it.
You saw it.
So congrats. And it was like, and being off Broadway is like a really, I did a toast at my brother's wedding in California and the DJ guy was like, afterwards he was like, that was an amazing toast, dude. And I was like, oh, thanks. And he's like, you're really good. Like that. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm actually an actor. He's like, I was going to say that was really cool. And he's like, I don't know if you live around here, but I always like need an extra person, like, you know, to like DJ and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, I don't live here. I live in New York and I do theater in New York. And he was like, do you do Broadway? And I was like, no, I don't, but I do off Broadway. And he's like, don't we all? Because it was like, if you're not doing Broadway, and I wanted to be like, off Broadway is a real thing. Like, it's hard to do off Broadway, you know. But I didn't. I was just like,
it's actually the same exact work. There's literally just fewer seats in the audience. Like, it has absolutely.
I know, but I couldn't. I was just more like, yes, we all do off Broadway.
Wow, but just think, like, had you turned right instead of left, you could have been like the. I don't know, like the guy who runs around and gets kids excited at bar mitzvahs to dance. Like,
the hype guy.
There's no reason.
Yeah, that's my fallback. That's him.
It's hard because if a kid doesn't want to play Coke and Pepsi. So anyway, sidebar.
That was sidebar. So anyway. Yes.
But by the way, you'll never forget that. Like, you could be accepting your Oscar and you'll be like, and also DJ guy, I am a real actor.
Yeah, I am a real actor. And off-Broadway is a real thing. We don't all do off-Broadway. I'm lucky to be doing it.
Exactly.
Anyway, yeah. So then there was a lot of drama with Clybourne Park and just in terms of it, moving it went to London first and they did a separate production at the National and it won an Olivier. And so I think because that was so successful there, they were like, still on Broadway. And Bruce, to his credit, because he's like I mentioned, he's this way, he was like, if we do it on Broadway, we have to do it with the original cast.
Which leads us all to this thing that might not even happen after the dream of it, like coming together, did happen and led to a phone call for you or watching TV or however you found out about your nomination.
Yeah. It was amazing. I knew the play was going to get nominated because it's such a good play. And so I woke up and watched like on the computer or maybe New York One or whatever, and I watched the nominations. You know, a lot of people, I always joke, I have friends who I joke with the fact that like everyone is asleep. Nobody's really, it's like, that's the story.
And I woke up like, and there were 22 up. Voicemails. Yeah. I was like, I can't be voicemails because I didn't get nominated.
Right. I've forgotten I forgot the Oscar nominations were that morning.
You're like, I never went to sleep for a week.
Right. And meanwhile, like, yeah, you've been like working it for like 3 weeks. But anyway, so I watched it and it was like the group of people, my name just happens to be the last alphabetically.
Yeah.
And so it was like just watching it and being like, oh, I don't think it's gonna happen, because it was like in my mind, it seemed like they'd already named like five or six people but then they said my name. It's definitely one of those things. I mean, a lot of things are like this in this business, right? Where it's like, you sort of imagine maybe that would happen, and then it does happen. And then it's like very surreal. And then it becomes just part of your life. And then, you know, it's either less or more than you thought it was going to be, or do more or less things for you. And then it's just sort of gone. And the only time you talk about it is like on podcasts, which I try to do a podcast every day so I can talk about it every day. So today, this is a good one for today.
Jeremy, podcasts are so easy to do. You could literally just host your own called My Tony Nomination, and just a little, like a moment, just even a one minute segment per day that really is just about your Tony nomination. I think about how many times, you know, I know you did like a hangar stage production of Picasso, at the Lepen with the Steve Martin play. Then you did Meteor Shower that Steve Martin wrote. And now I got to see you as I binged watched two seasons of Only Murders in the Building. And then in the second season, you are all over the damn thing. And I'm curious, did that come
It's the
your
third
way?
Season. I think that's the third season.
Sorry, the third season. I watched two and three. Forgive me.
Okay, yes.
Well, you've caught me out. It's so funny. That show is so ridiculously funny. Like, I will watch it and I'm laughing out loud to a TV show that never happens. Curb, right? There are certain shows that, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Right. I will laugh by myself. But that's a very rare thing. Is there a connection to you having worked with Steve a few times that you found yourself on that show, or did you go through the process like everybody else?
Yeah, I went through the process like everybody else. When I did Meteor Shower, I replaced someone in Meteor Shower like during rehearsals. So I didn't really even audition for that. But I had done readings of it before, but Jerry Zaks, I had done readings with other stuff with Jerry Zaks, and he sort of thought that I would be good for it. He knew me.
Yeah.
But then when I got an audition for Only Murders, I actually was speaking to the casting director, which I usually don't do before I'm doing, because I was confused about something, and they said, just ask the casting director, which I had never done, but it's kind of a cool thing to do. Talk to a casting director before.
Like your person, their person. Yes. like every other business in the world would be like, hey, before we do the big presentation today for the boss, do you want to like, I'll say this and you'll say this, but no, in our business, you're in a room like with no light, like Guantanamo, and then you great, now go. Yeah. So was this on Zoom? Like, was this in the world of Zoom audition still? Or
no,
back
it
in
was
person?
It was the first time, and also now the only time that I auditioned in person since COVID.
Yeah.
I asked the casting director, like, I know Steve a little bit, like, should I like write him an email and say I'm auditioning? And she was like, I don't think so. I mean, normally I might, but like with Steve, I don't know like his relationship with that and if he would feel comfortable. And I said, I just went and auditioned. But in terms of like John Hoffman, who created the show with Steve, who runs the show, who was running the audition, like immediately made me feel at ease because he was like, I loved you in Clybourne Park. And, you know, so that's always like a thing. I mean, I wish that I wasn't like that, but it's like when I feel like someone knows me or like respects me, it's like I feel so much more relaxed instead of feeling like I'm trying to prove myself.
Yeah.
Which should be just a mental thing that I should be able to switch, but you know, it's hard to feel. There's a desperation with auditions that can sometimes like overtake you because you're just trying to get something that you want.
Do you still feel that way? Has that calmed down, you know, 25 years in
I sometimes get offers, and then when I do audition, a lot of times I have that feeling because it's like they really want to see you, this person knows you, and so I'm able to like get that feeling. But a lot of time, other times when I know that nobody really knows me, or like such and such knows you, but the writer needs to see you or whatever, it's hard not to just get to feel like, you know, I'm trying to prove myself in a way that isn't useful for acting or, you know, for anything. It's not useful even in a conversation to feel like I have to prove that I'm this to this person, just to be yourself and do your work. So I think that's why I don't like auditioning, because I don't like the power dynamic of it. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a mental thing. And ultimately, when you stop recording, you'll do therapy with me about it. But I thank you.
Can I keep recording? Because I think it would be so good for everyone.
Yeah, it's useful.
It's
useful.
The number of people who say, I would have never gotten this part if I had to have auditioned for it, right? Like these beautiful, huge parts that changed the landscape of their careers forever. They were like, let me tell you, had I not replaced someone at the 11th hour, had I had to read, never. My nerves would have derailed the process, even as a fully grown, experienced person who's been on both sides of the audition table over time, right? Like,
I mean, I think
crazy.
It's like a combination of nerves. It's a combination of nerves and at least for me.
And resentment.
exactly.
Like, really?
Like anger.
I'm sorry.
Right.
I've done this exact part, actually 42, this part.
right. Yeah.
Oh,
I think it is. It's like a resentment and all, and you know, like I said, proving yourself, sort of like coming from a place of like, I can do this, instead of just like, and so that's also why it's like, who knows if I would have gotten Clybourne Park if I auditioned for it, because I was just doing a reading of it. So I was already felt like I got asked to do this thing, and I was just like doing it and like playing with it. And like I said, it's so tricky. I mean, because it should be just a switch that you can turn in your mind. I mean, I remember my former agent used to say, like, I know you like it when there's like a star next to your name, when someone's like saying they really want to see you to do this, but you should be able to just act like there's a star by your name. But, you know, it's hard to convince yourself that a group of people that are seeing there kind of uninterested really are excited to see you. But of course, that's supposedly the trick to auditioning, is that they really want you to do well.
Yeah, I mean, they say that, right? You know what? We're just waiting for you to be the answer to our question. And I'm like, well, your body language is not You're wearing a neutral mask and a black unitard. Like, I do feel like
the way you're eating that sandwich is making me feel like
on the phone.
On the phone and looking at my resume and not
or somebody else's resume. I'm like, I actually stopped once and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm not. That's actually not. I thought there was a mistake that the casting director had handed them the wrong picture and resume. So I was like, oh my God, before we start, I don't know if you're aware, that's not. And they were like, no, I know.
It's the next person. We've already moved on.
The person who was just in, who just got it. But please, go ahead. Amy Sedaris used to do, have you ever been in a waiting room?
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Day?
Wait, I was about to say that.
Yes, well, you tell it, because you'll tell it more hilariously.
Well, I don't know if it's the same thing, but that's so funny. I was about to say the same thing. I auditioned for a thing that was at the Long Wharf. And it was at the old Telsey by in the Floral District, you know, like on 28th Street.
Yeah.
And I was in the waiting room with like James Urbaniak and whatever. Anyway, Amy came out of the room and she's like, okay, I'll see you in New Haven.
Do that for everything. She was like, that's an early call, but I'll make it. Like, literally, she just had this bit where she would walk out, listeners, and basically like high five everyone and be like,
I got it.
Like,
even to the people that are waiting to do her
it
part.
It was exactly. And it was hilarious. So it's why she's who she is. But
that's so funny.
Also,
I was about to say that exact thing.
Yes, but when you went in after her, it's
of course.
Like, what can I possibly?
And they're still laughing and
they're
like
dying.
Talking,
they're dying.
Like they're talking dying. About what she did, and then they're like, "Okay, sorry." And you are,
No. But they would even try to be even more generous and be like, "This, okay, this is your time now. We're done."
Right. We're
this
done.
This is all
about
you. We are shining our light on you. Go ahead.
Do your thing.
Oh my God. It's such a, I think about like, I mean, there are other people who have to perform under incredible pressure, right? Like surgeons. Athletes, right? I mean, more in like what we do, this idea that you have to go out and pump your, this idea of pumping yourself up, whatever that means, and getting yourself ready. And it is really, really an incredible thing where you get to a point, and I think I feel this way more, and I feel like you probably do too, that when you do something a long time, it happens, but I know the people now on the other side of the table, and I come in with two things, like, we just had dinner last night and I'm auditioning. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
but
that's
also
tough. Yeah.
We had dinner together last night and I love you and you love me. And so let's work together. But I think when you do start looking at it as just an opportunity to work, but it really is hard to come in. And that's the trick, like to come in with joy. No matter what the thing is, and because it's an incredibly, like I was looking at your, you know, I read a thumbnail sketch of your credits. It's like, Jeremy, you have had this unbelievable career and you have just like, and had a life where you also have like had a family and children and great friends, and you just keep reinventing yourself. Like you do not repeat yourself a lot. It might be a comedic role, but it's like a whole new thing. And I did, it's just incredible. And I'm so wowed by what you've done and the wonderful way you are in this world of making theater and television. And it's like, you're so talented and you're so kind and you're so funny and your work is just extraordinary. And I really thank you. Like I've known you peripherally for a really long time. You know, we stood and watched our kids do gymnastics together. We've been at like beautiful weddings together. And it's really nice to like get to just talk to you today and understand like the human inside, like, thank you. Thank you for being vulnerable and funny and smart and generous with your time. So thank you.
Well, thank you. It was a great talk. It was a fun, it's fun to just like talk with someone and especially with you.
Well, I understand at Equity, there's a lounge where, you know, people meet and we could just.
Yeah, right. Or we could wait in line
and tell stories all day. All right. Before I let you go, is there a little known fact that you can share about yourself?
Yes, I think only my, you know, dear friends know about this, or people that share a dressing room or whatever. I'm a huge Denver Nuggets fan. And I, for the last 3 or 4 years, I have watched all 82 games of the season, not without missing a game. So that's like a 2.5 hour times 82. I just don't miss it. You know, if I'm doing a show or whatever, I record it and I turn off my text. So my friends from Denver, I can't read what's going on.
You will not know the outcome. First.
I will not know the outcome. And I watch it. And I was thinking I'm going to say this as my little known fact. And then I was thinking like, it's pretty strange, but also I think it's like, it's my show. It's like it's very long form narrative show. It's a reality show, but it's like, I know the characters, I watch people develop. I see like a rookie get better. I see him lose time and not get to play as much. And it all culminated last year, this past summer, and they won the championship for the first time in their history. And it's just like my show. It's like a soap opera. And I watch it and I look forward to it. And it's like I think it's a little weird, but it also, and it does keep me from watching things. Like there are definitely shows that friends have been on that I haven't caught up to. And I feel badly about that, but maybe it's a guilty pleasure, but it's a little obsessive just in terms of the fact that I watch all the games. But it's an important part of my life.
It makes you so happy.
It makes me so happy.
It makes you so happy. Did you just sob when they won?
Yeah, and I was in Denver. I didn't go to the game, but I was with a bunch of friends from high school. And then we drove around and like people were honking and it was like,
awesome. This is in the last year.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is not this like is, a yeah. teenager, Jeremy. This is like you and then you
no,
got your
this
car
is like
and your
me. Yeah. Me like two haircuts ago. Yeah.
So, all right. I have one question for you. Have you missed out on like weddings or important events? Like, have you declined an invitation to something that might have been very important to someone? Because of a game.
My son's bar mitzvah.
Okay.
No.
And is your wife appreciative of this passion?
She is actually. She's very, very supportive. She's sometimes a little bit like, do you have work tonight? And then I'm like, no, I think that, you know, no, they're off. I don't say I think because I know their schedule.
Right.
But I haven't missed a lot of things. There are times when I just record it. And
right.
It's also like, sometimes I don't mind recording. There are a lot of the games are West Coast. So they start late anyway.
Right.
They start at 10 o'clock here anyway, and go to 1 o'clock. So if I go out and I get home at 11, I just start later. And I also enjoy like everyone's asleep and I'm just watching it. And then I clean up the kitchen afterwards. And it's just part of my, life.
I love it.
It's just
and it's
part
a
of my
win.
Life.
It comes with a Tony nomination and he cleans the kitchen. It's Jeremy Sheamus, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
Thank you for being on the
thank
show
you.
Today. Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know. I have some news. Little Known Facts is now available to watch on YouTube. Hours and hours and hours of interviews that you can see my fabulous guests. And guess what? It's called Little Known Facts with Alana Levine. Catchy, right? Anyway, head on over to YouTube and watch the podcast. And please don't forget to subscribe. Also, if you want to donate to the podcast, zero pressure. But if you want to, no donation is too big or too small. I am so grateful for you for listening. But if you want to donate, just go to littleknownfactspodcast.com/donations. Lastly, Little Known Facts is recorded in Brooklyn, New York, USA. My editor is Nicholas Klar. None of this happens without Nicholas. And the Little Known Facts theme song was composed and sung by Georgia Famusa with backup vocals by Caleb Famusa. Thank you for listening and have an amazing day.